The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, a couple of months ago, I had in mind to do a series of talks starting today and Monday evenings on some of the basic elements of Buddhist ethics. And today I was thinking, what was I thinking about? But somewhere I said I would do it, starting today. So, in a very general way of speaking, there are two aspects of Buddhism. And one, and I love the way that it was described by, I think I've heard indirectly, I read about it in the writings of Gary Snyder, who studied Zen in Japan in the early 60s. And he came back and said he learned in Japan that in Zen there are two things. There's meditation, and then there's sweeping the temple. And but the temple doesn't stop at the temple gates. Basically, the whole world's your temple. So there's meditating, which represents a whole domain of Buddhism. And then there's the part of being of service, or acting in the world, or working in the world. And interesting, in early Buddhism, nirvana is kind of the goal or the ultimate kind of possibility of what's often represented as meditation. It's characterized by peace. And it's one of the great directions a person can set their life, is to bring their life to some where there's no conflict anymore, there's no fighting, there's no war, there's no fear, and there's a profound sense of peace that one experiences. So it's really an amazing thing, direction to go in your life. So nirvana is, liberation is characterized by peace. But the Dharma is said to be characterized by non-violence or non-harming, ahimsa. And so on one hand we have peace, on the other hand we have non-violence. The Dharma here can be understood to be the path of practice, the practices a person engages in, kind of the Buddhism. Dharma sometimes is another word for religion. So the path of practice has a lot to do with non-violence. The results of the practice has a lot to do with peace. And I think it's a very interesting kind of dynamic. A lot of people in the West come to Buddhism because of the meditation practice. And a lot of people, maybe some of you even here tonight, will come to Buddhism not at all interested in Buddhism, and or not at all interested in the isms of Buddhism. And you might have a ism around non-ism. Non-ism is your ism. And you're not one of those ism people, you're a non-ism. Meaning that you don't want the religious part of it, and so just give me the meditation. And which many people have taken that approach, and it's been of great benefit to them. But what it ends up looking like then is that Buddhism might be just a meditation, just some introverted kind of approach to living a life. If you go look at the teachings of the Buddha and much of Buddhism, meditation is often considered to be kind of the cream of the cake or the pinnacle of a wide range of practices. And that a big percentage of what Buddhism is about, Buddhist practice is about, is relational. It has to do with how we relate to the world, how we relate to others, and clarifying and developing and and resolving our relationship to the world. Meditation, at least kind of in the kind of maybe the most obvious impression people get, is not about being in relationship. Some people complain that you sit down to meditate and close your eyes and you shut out everybody else, and it seems what's that have to do with people? Some people who are extreme introverts find meditation to be a great solution. And some people who like to escape life find meditation to be a great, kind of benefit for them because it's a wonderful way to escape. And in fact, sometimes meditation is counterindicated, or sometimes people point out, you have to be very careful, you don't use meditation as an escape from responsibilities and from, connections. And one of the ways to safeguard that in Buddhism has been that meditation practice follows after having developed your healthy relationships to the world. In English, we sometimes call this the world of ethics, developing the ethical side of Buddhism. And, sweeping the temple, but the temple doesn't end at the temple gates. Caring for the world, caring for ourselves. So the Dharma is characterized by nonviolence. And this has all kinds of different meanings. The most obvious one is that people who live the Dharma, who are going to live the Dharma, are living a life that's dedicated to being nonviolent, to not being in conflict, in aggressive or hostile kind of conflict with people. And to train themselves in that. What does it take to develop a healthy relatedness? How do we take care of ourselves in a healthy way without being in hostile conflict with others? So that has one aspect. The other aspect is how to live so we don't have a hostile conflict to ourselves. How do we be nonviolent towards ourselves? And for many people, this is really the big, difficult area of meditation practice. We sit down and meditate, close our eyes, and lo and behold, it's one's relationship to oneself or relationship to the world that comes to the forefront. And so all the unresolved issues will bubble up sooner or later. Or meditation practice, as you sit and get calmer and calmer in meditation practice, there's a way in which we drop down into layers and layers of our psyche, and the places that are maybe deeply, deep down inside, which are unresolved, tend to bubble up. And unresolved, generally, from a lot of people, means that there's some kind of conflict there. So how do we come into that place where there's unresolved things and relate to it without conflict, relate to it in a nonviolent way, with compassion? So the ethical side of Buddhism begins with the practice of generosity. The Buddha, when he often taught, encouraged people to first develop generosity. Then he emphasized other kinds of ethical practices: not killing, not stealing, not lying, no sexual misconduct. Generosity has to do with our relationship with each other, with other people. You can be generous to yourself, but mostly generosity has to do with other people. So the starting point in Buddhism, classically, has not been meditation, but has been an interrelational practice of generosity. If you practice generosity, you get to bump into people, those people. And you get to find out what your relationship is to people, what your relationship is to being in a generous, healthy, open-handed, open-hearted, open-minded relationship to others. And that's a very, very rich world in which to understand oneself. How we're afraid of people, how we maybe cling to our things, our concepts, our ideas of stuff. And so we get to explore how can we find a way to be relating to people in a healthy way. The practices of not killing, not harming, not lying, not involved in sexual misconduct, not stealing, are also relational practices. And the corollary of those are also relational. So the corollary of not harming is to act and live compassionately. The corollary of not stealing in Buddhism is to be generous. The corollary of no sexual misconduct is contentment. So like if you're in a committed relationship, to be content in that committed relationship. The corollary of not lying is to speak not only honest speech, but also speech which is kind and beneficial. If a person takes on these as practices, looking at their speech, looking at their behavior, there's going to be a way in which we're going to learn a lot about ourselves in that process. And we're going to have to kind of wrestle with ourselves. Some people are going to have to wrestle with themselves about what's most important for them, their values, and how they see themselves in relationship to others, how they see others in relationship to themselves. And there's a whole big area of development, personal development, that goes into looking at these ethical aspects. So the classic way that meditation practice is taught in Asia, in Buddhism, is you start with these ethical aspects. And once those are a little bit established, then at some point you might introduce meditation. Here in the West, there's a strong tendency to do it upside down. Many people will come to meditation first, and then after some time of doing meditation, it dawns on them, you know, there's some connection here between the level of integrity or peace or well-being that I get in meditation and how I live my daily life. And it doesn't make sense to only have this peace when I meditate. It makes sense to kind of then to start exploring what goes on in my daily life, how to bring this into my world and my relationships. And so you find then many people that after some years or months or whatever doing meditation practice, they get interested in that world of relationships and how do we do it and develop good relationships there. One of the reasons why this is very important is that meditation practice, because it kind of drops down or opens up the mind in a very full way, in that stillness or quiet of deep meditation, we encounter, some people can encounter their neurosis, encounter the places where as I said earlier, unresolved issues, places in which maybe people are not fully psychologically developed. Maybe everyone's not fully developed everywhere, but there are ways in which people don't get psychologically developed fully. And so it can be very frightening and very difficult to go into the world of meditation unless there's a very strong, in Western psychological language, there's a strong ego development that's been created. People don't have a strong ego development, ego structure, meditation practice can be quite difficult at times, because meditation practice, there's so much calm that if there's not a strong ego structure to hold that, some of the more unusual psychological things could start happening. The person can regress, for example, and start feeling and acting and thinking like a four-year-old. So practicing ethics, generosity and precepts, it's also a way of developing what in modern psychology is called ego structure. Buddhism doesn't have the language of ego structure, but it talks a lot about developing various good qualities, psychological qualities. So one of the classic ones in Buddhism is called paramis, paramitas or perfections. Developing generosity, developing ethics, developing patience, developing wisdom, developing truthfulness, developing loving kindness, developing compassion, equanimity. An interesting one is developing what may be in Western terms would be called will, in Buddhism is called resolve, developing a strong sense of resolve. And so you develop these qualities, and as these qualities become stronger, then it's easier to let go more fully, because there's an inner psychological structure that'll hold a very deep letting go. And deep letting go is needed if we want to be able to touch the peace that is one of our potentials. This very deep sense of peace requires that we let go of the places where we're in conflict, where we're holding or resisting. And so there's a wonderful then kind of interrelatedness between these two spheres, the sphere of the world and the sphere of meditation, the sphere of meditation and sweeping, the world of the Dharma and the world of Nirvana. And so they support each other back and forth. So the characteristic of the Dharma is nonviolence. And that becomes one of the guiding principles in Buddhism for how a Buddhist will live their life or find their life or find their practice. What is a nonviolent thing here? What's a non-harming thing in this situation here? The non-harming thing is meant to be the flip side of that, explicitly stated, is that which is compassionate. How do we abide with compassionate concern, compassionate regard for the world around us? So that's what I wanted to say tonight. And what I'd like to do now is to hear from you, with that introduction to Buddhist ethics, what kind of concerns or questions, comments you'd like to make around this topic of the world of our relationships, the world of how we are living in the world. And that also will maybe give me some sense of what direction to go over the next couple of weeks as I continue talking about Buddhist ethics. So if you can take the mic, that would be helpful. And then pass it back there. To the chairs.
Is it on? No?
You might have to push the button. It's on.
You were talking about generosity. I'm dealing with that myself. In this age that we're going through right now, or this economic downslide that we're going through right now, the idea of donations, how do you donate what you may not have? Because for some people, they can't get a job.
Yeah.
Or all the ramifications of what we're going through right now.
Yeah.
So then, how do you donate?
You start with your smile. There you go.
So I'm serious. I donate a lot of money to elephants in Africa,
great.
Kenya. But I've had to rethink that.
So I think that part of generosity is hopefully to have the wisdom to know what's appropriate to give, how much to give, where to give. And so if you don't want to give, probably you don't want to give so much that it starts hurting you. And so if you're in financial difficulty, or if your finances have gotten poorer than they were before, then I imagine you have to make an adjustment and figure out and donate less to something. And maybe that's unfortunate in many ways, but maybe it's realistic.
But then there's the idea that comes within myself that I am being...
Sorry?
The idea that comes within myself.
I missed a word. The idea.
Oh, that I'm being selfish.
Oh, selfish.
Yeah, and only caring about myself.
I started off. You know, you could start with a smile. There are many ways of extending your life beyond yourself, so you're not selfish. But that doesn't require a lot of money, and so there are probably people right on your street where you live who need help or. You know, there's things you can do very locally. It doesn't require much money. It just requires if you have the time. Or maybe it doesn't even require much time, but maybe it requires a certain way of being with the people you do spend time with, that you get more interested in them. You offer them your ear and just listen more carefully. So I would explore ways that you can be generous without being with money. So back in the corner there. You could pass it back all the way to the corner.
When you spoke about the ego structure being able to hold being a container essentially for the ethical development, I have difficulty in understanding the difference between that and the egocentricity as separate from self. Could you speak a little bit more about
that? So the difference between being selfish, egocentric, and developing a strong ego structure?
More around the practice of noticing the difference of I from egocentricity, or that sense of separateness from everything versus the oneness, and then the ego structure.
So we restate it. So the question is, what's the difference between being egotistical or narcissistic, focus so much on oneself, versus ego structure? Because if it seemed like developing a strong ego structure, using that language might reinforce being egotistical and keeping oneself kind of narcissistically separate from others. Something like that?
Right, yes.
It's certainly a good one to be concerned about. Some of it, I think, has to do with the confusion around words. Even the word ego is a confusing word because it has different meanings by different speakers in English. I think the original idea coming out of Freud had to do with not being egocentric or narcissistic, but had to do with inner psychological strengths that help one balance the different forces in the within us so we can live a healthy life. But in Buddhist English, in most forms of Buddhist English, the word ego is considered really bad. And so then it becomes very confusing because my therapist is talking about developing ego and my Buddhist teacher is telling me to destroy the ego. And, they should talk. But I think that's why I tried to use the word ego structure, is to qualify it. I could easily drop the word structure and talk about having developing enough psychological strength so that we can be really honest. Being honest is a form of strength, truth-telling, so that we can have inner stability, so we can be present for what's going on. You use the word oneness. If we don't have some inner strength when we become one, in a sense, then we might actually merge too much with the other person and lose ourselves in the process in an unhealthy way. So developing strong mindfulness, as we know what's going on, what we're feeling and thinking and what's going on, is very important in being connected in a healthy way with others. So Buddhism doesn't use the word ego, but it does use the idea of developing these mental factors, these mental qualities, that in modern psychological terms could be called ego structure. What Buddhism also adds to this is that through the mindfulness practice is the careful attention to suffering and to clinging. And narcissism involves a contraction, involves suffering, involves clinging. And so as we're developing ourselves, hopefully in Buddhist practice, we're noticing the ways in which we're limiting, we're self-limiting, we're restricting ourselves through being egotistical, and we feel a suffering of that. And so hopefully we'll learn to free ourselves of that as well. Is this a satisfying answer to you?
Yes, it is.
It is?
Thank you.
Oh, good. So next to you here, there's someone else.
So if I understand correctly, it sounds like generosity and ethics are sort of pathways to help strengthen ego structure. And then perhaps meditation is a more of a pathway towards, one could say, maybe dissolving the ego structure or resolving deeper energies that are in the psyche or in the ego structure. But I'm wondering in sort of modern Western times if perhaps other pathways are needed for some of us to develop strengthen the ego structure in order to even get to being able to be generous and practice the ethics.
Maybe. It could be. So what occurs to me is to think of kind of a developmental model for human growth, starting with, as a baby and childhood and up. And what some psychologists will point out is that is that for some individuals, that developmental stages of growth get interrupted or get truncated or don't get completed as people are growing up through childhood. And then you become an adult with this incomplete stage. And so sometimes you might be right that a person has to go back and somehow deal with these undeveloped areas of their life. So for example, an important aspect of early childhood is to learn to have a certain kind of healthy separation from others, boundaries between self and others, at the same time as having a healthy trust in others as well. And if there's not if a young child doesn't have trusting relationship with their parents, or doesn't find a way to have healthy sense of separation from their parents or whatever, then it can be quite difficult as an adult. And so how do you find that? How do you develop that? Is certainly an issue for psychotherapy, that classically in this society here. So maybe you're right that other things are needed. But I would suggest that generosity is a very simple practice. And ethics is not maybe as simple, but it's kind of clear whether you're beating someone with your fists or not, you know. Or and so as a person explores the world of generosity, I think that it's one of the places to begin. Maybe not 100%, but it's one of the ways of beginning to work on some of these developmental issues that might be left over from childhood. Is this making some sense? And I knew someone who came back from long retreats in Asia, and she had a number of psychological problems. She had obsessive compulsive disorder and a variety of other things, so that it was really almost impossible for her to meditate. She was really anymore. She'd meditated there quite a bit and just had gone, because of her issues, just meditation was probably the wrong thing for her to do, and it just made everything worse. And she came back and she couldn't really meditate anymore, but she still was really into Buddhism. So she went to her Buddhist teacher and, what do I do? And he said, you practice generosity. And that's what she did. And that gave her stability and grounded her, brought her back into her body, back into the world of relatedness. And it wasn't a cure for her, but it kind of was a really important stepping stone to that healing that she had to go through.
Can I ask you in what forms she practiced generosity? What it looked like for her?
It was really ordinary things. She worked in a kitchen. She cooked for people. She went out of her way to help people who wanted to be, you know, needed some kind of errand or something. It was pretty basic, simple things.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I have a question about motivation and ethics. Is it ever okay to, you know, kill or steal or something like that if it seems to be, you know, I don't know. I saw this movie that was deeply disturbing to me, and I got confused because at first I was really taken aback by the character's, what I thought was extraordinary generosity. And they started all this because they were a work addict and they couldn't stop working, and then they were looking at their Palm Pilot while they were driving, and the car got in an accident and 7 people were killed, including a person I think he was to marry. And so he apparently couldn't live with that. And the only way he felt he could make amends for what he did was he took his brother's badge and he tried for the IRS and he tried to change other people's lives and give them grace, you know, grace periods and this and that. And then so he took that without asking, and then he was like generously helping people. And then at the end, he committed suicide. Because this woman he fell in love with had a permanent heart defect, and nobody could save her. And so, I guess he felt bad, or he couldn't live with that he took his fiance's life through this accident. And he took his own life, and he was a living organ donor, and he donated parts of his body and to people that were suffering, and he took his own life, and this woman, unbeknownst to her, got his heart. And at first I thought this was unbelievable. This was such an extraordinary act of generosity. And then later I realized, well, it's probably a violation of all kinds of ethics, like suicide, stealing, and maybe he was motivated by guilt. And so I was really confused. And yet I wonder how many people, millions of people, go around giving a variety of things, maybe out of some subconscious, unbeknownst to them, guilt.
Great. That's one of the reasons why generosity is a great practice. As a practice, we don't just do it blindly, but we do it looking at what's going on. We look at our motivations, look at our feelings and what's going on for us. And that kind of that study of ourselves, because often generosity can have a lot of mixed motivations behind it. And just to give for giving's sake, without any kind of care given to studying or being aware of why we're giving, I don't think we're going to develop as much as if we really study what's going on there. And it's a great practice. It's great to practice giving when you don't feel like it, because that's also a place where you can then study yourself and find out what's going on. There's a lot of mixed things going on there. So here.
The kind of like an ethics issue that I'm curious about is that it seems like the action is fairly easy. That's like, you know, I mean, you slip up once in a while, but it seems like, you know, it's not so hard to do the action. But like, I'm shocked at when a lot of times I will just look at someone and I'll catch myself sort of attacking them in a pre-verbal moment, so that I can have power in the relationship, or I will do something to sort of be, you know, sort of seductive or charming to them, and it's kind of disturbing to see how, like, I almost like I have these impulses, like I'm at a gambling table and I'm trying to get all the chips, or, you know, get the good cards and stuff, and so it doesn't turn into action, but I'm like, you know, just seeing it sometimes is a little disturbing. And
so the question is, how to be ethical at the gambling tables?
You know, like not like kind of if you've noticed yourself operating like you're at a, you know, operating in life like you're at a gambling table.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So what you're trying to manipulate and control and get the best from it, and it's pre-verbal. I mean, it's very quick, the motivations and all that. Well, there's a variety of things. One is just, it looks like you've looked at it some. Maybe look at it more, understand it more. Share that information with some of your friends, like you're doing here, and so it becomes much more conscious and highlighted for you. So you become more and more conscious of that whole phenomena, and then once you become more and more conscious of how it is and have studied it for a while, then you might consider what some options you have for addressing it more directly. So if it's gambling, it's connected to, you might choose not to gamble. But I mean, that was just an example you gave. It's happening other times in life.
But I mean, I think social interactions are like
I like gambling, yeah. So then you look at it, and then you decide, you know, what would be helpful to do here. In some situations, you say, maybe I need to prepare myself before I go into some certain kind of relationships. Maybe I need to meditate, go for a walk, take a few deep breaths, kind of check in with myself before I'm going to have that phone call, or before I'm going to meet that person. So we prepare ourselves. And one of the reasons for meditation is to prepare yourself so you can go into the world in a calmer way and see more clearly what's going on. So you're prepared. And it isn't just calm. One of the really important roles of meditation is people associated with more peaceful and being more calm, but it might actually be more important or equally important that meditation hopefully will give a person a sense of well-being. And as there's a sense of well-being within, then we're not going to be, we're less likely to look for our well-being in controlling and manipulating the world around us. So rather than getting our well, so if you don't, if a person doesn't have any inner well-being, then they'll go gambling, or they'll do, you know, something strange in the world to try to get it. But if you already have it, then it's easier. So prepare oneself for those situations might be helpful. Another is make sure you don't keep it private. Sharing the issues that you're grappling with other people. Will you say it to other people? This is what I'm grappling with. Oh, I did it again. You know, and not exactly like confession, but something like that. Confession is a loaded word. But there's a way if you share with someone else your behavior, what you've done, it takes some of the power and identification away from it, and it might help you kind of loosen up, and so that's another approach that occurs to me here. Here in the back, and if you could pass the mic back there.
I guess for me, I find myself struggling with like resolve and will and how to do that in a compassionate way.
So how does it happen? And what's the, can you say a little bit more about how it plays out?
Well, I mean, how to, you know, practice resolve or will without like negative self-talk, you know, like, oh, you know, you said you were, you know, talking to myself, oh, I said I was going to do this or I was going to do this in a particular way because I resolved to, you know, do something differently, and then I don't meet that expectation, and then get involved in a process of self-negative talking, which isn't compassionate.
Yeah.
To myself, at least.
It's just astounding how many people have a lot of strong self-critic, ready to criticize themselves, and it's very painful. This way people to be critical of themselves, hypercritical, or judgmental, or feel in some ways unworthy or inadequate or bad or something. Some people find it very helpful to spend a period of time cultivating loving kindness and compassion. So not leave loving kindness or forgiveness or compassion to chance and try to call on it when we're struggling, but actually make it a regular practice to, and Buddhism offers a variety of practices to do to cultivate loving kindness so it becomes more easily accessible, so it becomes like a habit almost, it's available. So we kind of recondition the mind a little bit, so the mind is more inclined towards having forgiveness, having compassion, having loving kindness. And some people find it very helpful to spend a few months, and the primary meditation practice would be loving kindness meditation. And that can begin, for some people, softening the places of hate or self-criticism or judgment and all that. Another approach is, it would be more mindfulness approach, is to look more deeply at the nature, at what's going on when we're being self-critical. And there's an interesting phenomena that people who find themselves struggling with judgments, either judging themselves negatively or judging others in some negative way, that it's a painful phenomena, and it's possible then to, you know, so you know you didn't follow on your resolve, and so you criticize yourself for being a lousy resolver. And then you criticize yourself for being critical of yourself. And then, you know, and then it goes on from there, you know. But if you look carefully it's some people find it very interesting to ask themselves the question, what benefit are you trying to get by being judgmental? What benefit are you trying to get? So kind of assume, give it a benefit of doubt that maybe there's some kind of attempt to do something healthy there. And what is it, that healthy thing you're trying to do by being judgmental? And that taking that different angle on it might kind of open the door to see it in some new way. And some people have found that that the motivation between being judgmental is to try to make themselves safe. And so by making themselves, they want to be safe. And by sometimes judging other people, if they're really wrong, if they're bad, then I must be okay. And the effort is not so much about judging them, but to create a sense of safety here for me. And so there might be something healthy buried deep inside of your self-criticism. And maybe it's self-respect. And maybe if you find this, maybe you can find behind the self-criticism some healthy sense of self-respect. Oh, I let myself down here. I'm trying to find a way to find my strong sense of self-respect, and I've disappointed myself, and now I'm trying to be critical. I'm trying to attack something that's interfering with my self-respect, but it's a dysfunctional way of doing it. So if you can, sometimes you can, if you go back far enough in the mind to the cause, to the what builds up to criticism or judgments, you can sometimes find something more healthy, a healthier approach to it. And then in Buddhism, what we encourage is when we've done something that we may casually say wrong, we've done something we don't feel so good about, Buddhism encourages us not to feel guilty. Guilt is considered to be an unnecessary emotion in Buddhism. Buddhism does not encourage guilt. In fact, discourages it. But you are encouraged to pay attention, to notice how you've let yourself down, how you've done something maybe was a little bit off. Notice it enough, take it in enough, so that you, and then be forward-looking. How can I do better next time? So people are in guilt are just tend to be only backward-looking. In Buddhism, we look backward just enough in time to try to learn, and then we focus primarily, how can I do better next time? How can I learn from this so I don't do this again? So I could go on and on, but does that give you some ideas?
Yeah.
Something to work with? And
yeah, a couple ideas.
Okay. Oh, it's 9 o'clock. So the intention is to spend a couple of weeks here on some kind of issues around ethics. So it has a lot to do with how we are in the world and what Buddhism says about how we are in the world, more than what Buddhism has to say about how we are in meditation. And hopefully that we can explore this together and find it useful as a group to discuss this. So now you can go out and sweep the world.